It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in an attitude of prayer. Since we must fail, let us fail at high endeavors. Let us not fail to be mediocre when we could instead fail to be absolutely brilliant. Let us not fall short of being moderately compassionate. Let us rather fall short of being fully compassionate. Of all our failures in life, perhaps the saddest are those in which we failed even to try and serve the highest and noblest ideals. It is a sin to fail at low aims, not because we failed, but because we aimed too low. But it is not a sin to fail at the very highest aims, like aiming for truth, justice, compassion, and character. Because even our failures put us into the company of the saints, the company of those who also believe that rising to our full humanity and rising to our full divinity may be the same rising. Striving after low and mean ends is a boring sin, not worthy of us. Let us have greater ambition for our failures. Let us vow never to fail at anything that wasn't noble or proud. Never to settle for lower aspirations for ourselves, our lives, or our world. We will all fail at some things, but let it not be a failure of vision, a failure of aspiration. If we must fail, let us fail at high endeavors, and then let our failures bless us, for they will. Amen. Today's sermon is really prepared as a companion piece to the program that I'll be doing here in 2 weeks on being human religiously on the 31st and the 1st, Friday night and Saturday. And that'll be a look at the soul of what liberal styles of religion have been about in all religions in the world for the last 2,500 years. I have cut the length of this sermon down from its original length of 9 days. I'm also still thinking about the idea of spirit that I started here last week, talking about the horse in the house. That story, which I'd told many times but had never written out, I finally wrote out because I took a picture of the picture, so I have a digital file of it for the first time. So that story and photo will be on our website sometime soon, just in case your friends really don't believe what's going on. Last week, the argument was partly in fun. It's the notion that there is a spirit to life that can appear without warning, that breaks all boundaries, that can transcend anything we're doing, that can be very disruptive, sometimes in fun ways and sometimes in revelatory ways. And since we can find stories about that kind of spirit everywhere, in every culture, in every religion, it's fair to call this spirit something that's transcendent and that's eternal and even infinite, to put it in the poetry of the spirit. But religion is about deciding to live in relation to that spirit. As one mystic put it, religion is the whole soul finally becoming what it believes. That was the Hindu, Vivekananda. What a wonderful statement. Religion is the whole soul finally becoming what it believes. There's a lot more to that, even than it sounds like, and I'll turn it around as we go on. So this morning I want to think about what the heck that means, and why anyone would want to do it, what's in it for you, and how to do it. A lot of people would say that being human religiously is simply about standing before God, and that's certainly one way to put it. You could say it depends on which God you're standing before, and that's fair too. For a lot of people, if you think of the God of Western religions, especially the versions of it that make the newspapers nowadays, this could be a pretty unattractive idea. That God so often seems to be about judging and punishing and narrowing acceptable limits for people, even wiping out people who displease him. And the thought of being judged by the God who created the whole shebang and isn't very happy and has high standards and punishes quickly, this is no wonder that polls now say that only about 21% of people in America attend any church service regularly. That isn't a real attractive poll. A lot of people think it'd make a lot more sense to reverse the formula and say, forget about being human religiously, why don't we just be religious humanly? Let's just drag religion down to what we can understand or say or maybe like. There's a lot of that going on. God and religion are dragged down to echo and endorse what we come up with, including some of the worst of the stuff we come up with, including some of our biases and our most dangerous behaviors. And sadly, you can see this by looking at almost every single culture and country where the power of whatever the local religion is has been combined with the power of whatever the local state is. You think about Muslim women in Iran who've been shot in the face by men because the women didn't wear the veil. And this is the name of their Allah. Or what may become several states following South Dakota's lead, criminalizing women who get abortions while also cutting social support programs, sex education programs, prenatal care, postnatal care, and health care. It's a pro-death policy wrapped in religious rhetoric. But in any country where the power of religion is combined with the power of the state, we can see people being religious at the human level rather than trying to be human at a religious level. We see religion being lowered rather than people being raised up. So why bother with the religion business? Maybe it's just outlived its usefulness. Now, you know I'm going to try to sell you this, right? So let's put it another way. If religion is about choosing to live in a commanding kind of relationship with ideals so high you can never fulfill them, who needs it? Why do it? What do you get out of it? Isn't it like sailors following a North Star that they have never reached yet? Why torment yourself with ideals so high you can never reach them? Now, once you ask it this way, the answer is kind of surprising. And it comes up, I'm going to suggest, from inside of you. I'm going to say some things this morning that may seem surprising, and you may want to check them out against your own mind and your own heart this week. Here's the first one. The reason we put our lives in the service of the very highest and most demanding ideals we know of is because it is the only way there is to become fully human, and we know it. We choose this route over and over, whether we care about religion or not. This transcends religion. Let me give you some examples from secular professions. But the pattern's very clear. Lawyers, I've been told, are really supposed to be committed to serve three different levels of responsibilities. First, but lowest, is the responsibility to serve their clients' wishes. Second is the responsibility to serve the law and the quality of the law. They shouldn't act in ways that will circumvent or weaken the rule of good laws. And that leads to the third and highest level of allegiance, which is to the greater good of society. They shouldn't take cases or work to set precedents that can make the world worse. Now, if this doesn't sound like a religious commitment, it should. The popular conception of lawyers is often that they only care about doing what their client wants, and there are some like that. I've never met them. I've never talked with them. I found an awful lot of very high idealism in the lawyers that I know. They believe that if they serve the highest of these ideals to the best of their ability, it is a noble profession that will not only make the world a better place, but make them better people. That's as religious as it gets, and I think they're right. Teachers. Teachers also serve different levels of ideals, and it all matters on how high the level is. At the lowest, and I'm sure the least satisfying level, teachers are just trying to get students to pass the test that'll be used to grade their school. But good teachers also have a love, a passion for education, learning, growing, truth, expanding their own horizons and the horizons of their students. They love the pursuit of truth in one form or another. And they give their lives to serving it, one class at a time, one student at a time. I've not met many teachers of whom this wasn't true. If there are teachers who don't care about anything but getting students through the test, I can't imagine that teaching is a very fulfilling profession for them. And then at the highest level, teachers hope and believe that they can be positive influences in forming the character of their students. That's a sacred charge. In helping to make them better people, better partners, and better citizens. I've had teachers who did that, so have you. Not many, but we never forget them. They gave us something precious, sacred, that will last our whole life long. And when they serve that, and know they serve that, they too can say they have served a noble profession that gave health and goodness to the world and gave health and goodness to themselves. Doesn't get a lot better than that. Doctors have the same kinds of ideals at different levels that drew them into this. It isn't about pushing pills. It's about serving health. It's about being part of a profession that cares for the quality of the lives of their patients and all the people around them, one patient at a time. I have a niece, 23-year-old niece, who's in her first year of medical school in Israel. She's going through Columbia University and chose a world medicine program that Columbia has, where the first 3 years are done in Israel, and then they have side trips to other cultures in the world where they learn other models of what health and healing are about. And right now her ambition is to be the next Albert Schweitzer. That's at 23. Who knows? When I asked Jordan why she was doing this, she said, it's religious. And I said, how is it religious for you? And she said, Jesus said that the quality of your faith is judged by whatever you do for the least among you. And she said, I can spend a whole life serving the least among me in Africa, in all of the countries that we'll be studying in the World Medicine Program. That's a religious mission. We could go down the list with a lot more. But the most important things in life, like justice and truth and health and love and character, they have to be served. You see if this isn't true. They have to be served by holding ourselves responsible to the highest ideals we can find. Nothing less. The higher the ideals we serve, the more gratifying we find the act of serving them, even as we will always fail at serving them perfectly. And all this is true on a more personal level, too. Forget about jobs and careers for a minute. Anytime we make a big deal of what we're about to say, oaths of office, weddings, anything where we dress up for it and want people to watch us, we are trying to articulate the highest ideals we know how to articulate. You think if you can find a good exception to it. If they aren't trying to make us committed to serving the highest ideals, we wouldn't dress up for it. I've never officiated at a wedding where the couple swore to more or less like each other for a while till they got bored, then split. I think there are a lot of dating contracts that may be like that. That's fine. That's why we call it dating. Never seen it at a wedding. There was a hit song in the 70s. I used to like it. And then the more I listened to the words, the less I liked it. That was true of a lot of the songs in the 70s. It was a great hit song. It sold millions of records. And the words were, "We'll sing in the sunshine. We'll laugh every day. We'll sing in the sunshine. Then I'll be on my way." I've never heard that sung at a wedding. At weddings, couples make bold, daring, amazing, risky, outrageous promises. These two people who really don't know anywhere near as much about each other or themselves as they think, they stand in front of God and all these witnesses and everything on earth that's holy to them, and they stand there and promise to love, honor, and cherish, keeping themselves faithful to the other for as long as they both shall live. It's amazing. But without aspiring to a commitment of that quality, there is no reason to get married at all. Save your money, sing in the sunshine, save your friends the trouble of dressing up. But nobody does that. Without the transcendent promises that call us to become more, that insist that we swear an allegiance to something much more. Without that, the whole idea of a wedding loses its magnificence of spirit, loses its nobility of human aspiration, it loses its magic, and it loses its blessing. See if you don't think that's true. Still, why do we do it? These aren't religious examples I've been picking now. But any time that we do something that feels deeply important to us, we always try to find the highest ideals we know how to articulate. We can do it in God language or in Christ language or in the language of Allah. We can do it in the language of great compassion from Buddhism. We can do it in ordinary language of serving justice and love and compassion and truth. No matter what language we're doing it in, that's what we're doing always. And there's something in us that demands it, that is part of what it means to be fully human. So when I say, why do we do it, it isn't a rhetorical question. There's an answer to it. Here's the reason for wanting to be human religiously. It's because, and you see if this doesn't ring true for you, it's because the highest satisfaction and the deepest and most abiding comfort in all of life can come only from being committed to and in the orbit of the very highest ideals we know how to say. It's the act, here's the magic, this is the miracle, it is the act of commitment that blesses us, not the act of achievement. That's amazing. It's seeing ourselves as being beloved of God or knowing Jesus loves us, feeling engulfed in the compassion of Allah or the Buddha or Kuan Yin. It's just trying to serve these things. Just that act blesses us, even if we don't do it perfectly. Because perfect ideals and perfect gods are also big enough to forgive us before we even begin for failing, because we'll fail. This all sounds poetic and foofy, but it's absolutely true. This is as hard as science gets. Now, you may know Christians as I do, for whom one of the most profoundly loving facts in their lives is the fact that, as they may say, Christ has accepted me just as I am. That's magic. That's powerful stuff. It's ironic. We can fail at trying to serve terribly high ideals, impossible ideals. We can fail at serving impossibly high ideals and still feel blessed by our aspirations. But if we try just to get by, to get away with what we can, if we drag our religion down to our lowest expectations so it will be easy to meet them, if we sing in the sunshine and then go on our way, when we look back, there is no blessing. Nothing about it had the power to bless us. There's more magic involved in this. When a Buddhist tries to see all others through the eyes of the Buddha's boundless compassion, or Kuan Yin's boundless compassion, it rubs off. They also come to see themselves through the eyes of boundless compassion. It rubs off. They have become what they tried to serve. Their souls have become what they believed, and it transformed their lives, and that's religion. A Jew, a Christian, a Muslim who tries to serve God, a God of love, in honest and earnest ways, lives a far more loving and beloved life than they might otherwise. It's absolutely true. As Vivekananda put it, religion is the whole soul becoming what it believes, not becoming what it achieves. That's the magic, becoming what it believes and what it tries to serve. That's amazing. If you believe the search for truth trumps lesser concerns, you become a person with more truth about you. If you believe compassion trumps every other consideration, there's a Buddhist saying that says when you're forced to make a choice between doing the right thing and doing the compassionate thing, do the compassionate thing. If you live that way, you will be a more compassionate person, and you will feel that you live in a more compassionate world than if you chose a different ideal. It really can be that easy. I suspect no marriage has ever quite lived up to the poetic vows of the wedding day, and no professional has ever really finished a whole career without being able to remember a whole slew of times that they failed, maybe even failed miserably, to live up to these high ideals that mattered so much to them. But in the long run, hopefully even in the short run, if we understand it, we don't condemn ourselves for the inevitable failures that come with being human. We are blessed by the ideals to which we give our lives, the compassion to which we give our hearts, the gods in whose services we enlist our souls. Think about it this week and see if this isn't true for you too. It's one of the greatest miracles in life. It truly is. And it is kind of like that picture of sailors steering their courses by following the North Star. No sailor will ever reach the North Star. It isn't possible. The North Star exists in a different plane than we live on. So do the ideals. So do the gods. But just following it changes the course of sailors completely. And when we align our hearts with the promise to love till death do us part, it changes our course as far as you can get from just wanting to sing in the sunshine and then go on your way. Think about it. It's tuning your entire life into a different key, and that changes everything. And it doesn't take great wisdom. We don't have to be saints. We don't have to be like Mother Teresa or Gandhi or Martin Luther King. Nobody can do that. We just have to try to be human in the best way we know how, try to follow that path like steering on the North Star. Just that is transformative. And that is one of the most important lessons to learn in life. I'll tell you about a young couple I met about 20 years ago. I had just started in the ministry, and they didn't attend the church. They didn't have a religion or a church. They wanted to get married, and they couldn't find anyone who'd marry them and came to ask if I'd do it. They were 18 years old, both of them. So I asked them, as I always ask couples, to write out their wedding vows. Now, we don't necessarily use the vows that couples write out, but I think it's important to try to put words around what it is you think you're promising. Couples have usually found this to be fairly hard to do. This couple found it to be impossible. One or the other of them phoned me at least 3 times, asking more questions, more specifications. I had no idea what was confusing them so badly. Finally, they said they wanted to come back in and talk some more about this. They were completely frustrated. "We can't do this," he said. And she agreed, "We don't know enough to write anything good enough for a wedding." In fact, they agreed, they hardly knew anything, period. Well, I said, "This really does sound serious. But you must know something. What do you know about yourselves and what you're hoping and what you're bringing? You must know something." No, they didn't. Between them, it started tumbling out. "We don't know anything about the future." They had this list made out. "We don't know what we'll be doing for work, even in 2 years, let alone in 40. We don't know yet if we'll have children. We don't even know yet if we want children. We don't know where we'll live. All we know is that we love each other like the other half of our own souls, that we'll be together for the rest of our lives, that together we can figure out anything we need to, and that, by God, that's going to have to be enough." Yes, those were the vows they read at their wedding. And nobody there will ever forget them. I have no idea what happened to the couple. I never saw them again. He had just joined the service and they had left somewhere for that. When we reverse it, though, when we drag religion down to the level of our most undeveloped parts, then we're not serving anything that's big enough to cherish us or to cradle us or to forgive our failures, since we've not tried to forgive the failures and the sins of others. It takes big ideals to do that. That's when God can become a fearful and oppressive thing, because then it isn't God at all. It's just our own small, lazy parts that we weren't willing to stretch and to allow to stretch us. Yes, it is all about living more wisely and well here and now, not elsewhere and later. As you'll learn when you come to the program at the end of the month, and I hope a lot of you can come to this, I think it's a good 8-hour program. It's something I've put together over the years and do at churches around the country, and it's really the first time I've done it here in this form. Almost all the best religious thinkers from all religions in history, this is over 2,500 years, have really been trying to help us become more human religiously, by orienting our lives to ideals as high and as demanding as they know how to articulate. When religion's taken seriously, and I think all the best styles of liberal religion, and that's what I call this, liberal religion rather than literal religion, the style of religion that says religion is about symbols and stories and metaphors about how do we live more wisely and well, what is demanded of us. How must we treat one another and ourselves? This is what they're all about. And it's not about pie in the sky, not in any of them. It's about pie here. It's about love here, and justice here, and compassion and truth here, and salvation by character here. It's what Jesus meant when he said that the kingdom of heaven isn't coming. You can't point to it. It isn't coming. It is within and among us, or it's nowhere. The attraction of becoming human religiously is simple. I think it's powerful. Understood right, it's saying, all right, here's the deal. If you'll try to believe in very high ideals, the kind that make impossibly high demands on you, and if you use your life to try and serve them, you will be blessed and accepted and forgiven for your failings. You don't have to earn salvation. You just have to enlist in the service of the highest ideals you can find, however you express them, and let them direct your life. Even when you fail, you will be blessed for having tried, and you'll feel this. The power of faith and living that faith can transform you, and your whole soul may become what you believe. And that may be the greatest miracle of all, now or later, here or anywhere. I can't guarantee to persuade you. I can only testify, and that's what I'm doing. The rest can only happen inside of you as you turn these things over in your heart, in your mind, in your life. But if it happens, you may experience it as a kind of miracle. And that kind of miracle, luckily, still happens a lot.